You're listening to a podcast hosted by Med Learning Group.
Welcome to this podcast on multiple myeloma hosted by Med Learning Group. This program will be geared toward community-based oncologists, hematologists, pharmacists, nurse practitioners, and physician's assistants who manage relapsed or refractory multiple myeloma. In this episode, we'll be taking a look at some of the disparities in care for patients with multiple myeloma, as well as resistance and some of the newer therapies. My name is Chris, and I will be the host of today's podcast. Joining me today is Dr. Caitlin Costello. Dr. Costello is a hematologist and medical oncologist, as well as associate professor of medicine with the University of California San Diego Health System. One of her main interests is treating plasma cell disorders, such as multiple myeloma, and she is heavily involved in clinical trials to help broaden therapeutic options brought to patients. Dr. Costello, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you, Chris. I'm delighted to join you.
Well, let's start with a little bit of background. How many people have multiple myeloma in this country, and what have the trends looked like over the years in, for example, new cases, death rates, or survival?
Great question. You know, many patients, when they're diagnosed with multiple myeloma, will say, I've never heard of this before. And the reality is that it's the second most common blood cancer in the U.S., second to non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, but still about the 15th most common cancer in the United States. And in 2020, there are approximately 170,000 people living with myeloma in the United States. Now, the next reality, however, is that only approximately 0.9%, less than 1% of men and women will be diagnosed with myeloma at some point during their lifetime. And this is based on data between 2017 and 2019. We know that the rate of new cases of myeloma was approximately 7 per 100,000 men and women per year. The death rate, however, is much lower than that, about 3 per 100,000 men or women per year. And again, this is based on data from about 2016 to 2020. And what we know now is that in 2023, there'll be approximately 35,000 new cases diagnosed with multiple myeloma in the United States. And in that same year, about a third of that number, 12,000 or so patients, will die of this disease. Now, when we look at this disease over time and we think about the percentage of new cases and deaths and five-year kind of relative survival rates, the curves or graphs that we use are extremely encouraging. You know, the last many years, we'll talk about this a bit, the last many years have just showed an explosion of new options for treatment. And combined with, to some degree, increasing awareness, we see more patients being diagnosed with myeloma, but more patients now living with myeloma and fewer patients dying year over year with myeloma. And so we can see that there's been a significant improvement in what we call the five-year relative survival rate of multiple myeloma, now approximately 60%. So really exciting things that have happened in these last many years in terms of how we have changed the outcomes of patients living with multiple myeloma overall.
Well, excellent. Thanks for that background on the disease state in general. One thing we wanted to emphasize with this CME podcast series is disparities in the care of multiple myeloma. So what do the data show on how this disease may be managed differently among, for example, certain races or perhaps more urban communities with underserved populations?
Thanks, Chris. This is a very relevant kind of discussion point. And, you know, what we knew and what we learned in med school, for example, is that every textbook will say that this is a disease or a cancer that seems to disproportionately affect patients of African-American descent or Black patients. And while we still have much to understand about why that is the case, we think that there's a bit of a difference in biology in the disease amongst white versus Black patients. Now, Black patients tend to be diagnosed at a younger age, maybe even 5 years younger than a non-Black patient. But the good news is that more Black patients tend to have what we call standard risk disease, meaning that their details of their disease may not include more high-risk features that may confer kind of a more aggressive multiple myeloma form. But it's not just the difference in biology that affects outcomes in treatment overall or outcomes in the disease. We know that maybe there's a difference in biology. However, we are very clear now that racial and socioeconomic status plays a great role in how we can see potentially less good outcomes in patients. Maybe that's because of higher financial toxicity. It can be expensive to have cancer. Food or housing insecurities, there can be cultural lack of trust in the healthcare system. These are all real and big barriers to getting access to good care. There can be cultural differences where maybe patients of unrepresented backgrounds may end up for withholding information such as side effects to their white providers, or may feel more comfortable sharing details of their disease course or side effects of treatment with same race staff with whom they may relate better. And then a next kind of stark reality is that, you know, with a lack of access, that also includes clinical trials. And, you know, clinical trials are the ways that we can understand outcomes better and give access to kind of cutting edge therapies. And we know that minorities are less likely to get more intensive or cutting edge therapies, treatments such as transplants, or have access to innovative clinical trials and therapies like CAR T cell treatments. And so all of these different disparities are very likely to result in different outcomes, which is a real unmet need in the medical field.
So you mentioned some of the differences based on biology, racial, socioeconomic status. Let's drive a little bit more into clinical trials. What's the disparity in clinical trials as far as representation of Blacks in clinical trials versus Blacks in the actual multiple myeloma population?
Great question. And there's been increasing interest in looking at these data points, exactly as you ask. And there is, you know, an FDA analysis ongoing that looks at, you know, the racial demographics in many of these multiple myeloma trials. And as I mentioned in the beginning, you know, Blacks represent a great proportion of the multiple myeloma population, maybe even upwards of 20%. However, in a good majority of our myeloma trials, the median percent of Black patients is really shockingly low, let's say just below 5%. And so when you're thinking about the outcomes of clinical trials, the reality is that these trials are not representative of the population affected by multiple myeloma. And so if there can be a real kind of movement to increase enrollment among Black patients, this would really provide us with significant improvements in understanding the biology of the disease in Black patients, identify different subtypes that are maybe genomic or molecular based that could help us improve our kind of established or our kind of next generation drugs that are available for treatments to see if some may be better than other for different patients. Maybe we can look at different race-associated side effects. I think there's so much that we don't understand because of this lack of representation in clinical trials.
Yes, definitely an important unmet need in the area of multiple myeloma. So let's shift to treatment. What are some of the early line therapies that you use for multiple myeloma?
So over the last one or two decades, it's really been a mainstay of treatment has included three major classes of drugs that we use when patients are first kind of diagnosed or within their first or second relapses. And those three main classes of drugs are called proteasome inhibitors, immunomodulatory drugs, and CD38 monoclonal antibodies. Now, these are our main three classes of drugs, the former two of which have been around a little bit longer than the CD38 monoclonal antibodies, but more and more trials are showing us how we can use these three classes of drugs and combine them effectively and base the choice of our treatment combinations on factors such as biology, as we mentioned before, but also patient-specific factors looking at comorbidities, age, frailty as examples, but just as much and just as important, you know, socioeconomic features such as caregiver support and transportation options and financial toxicity. So, you know, these three major classes of drugs really offer a variety of different combinations that can be used for patients when they're when they're newly diagnosed. Now, I didn't mention, but certainly alkylating agents such as the use of high-dose melphalan as part of our autologous stem cell transplant treatment is another class of drugs that is commonly used for patients who are felt to be eligible at high doses for transplant, but still has a role in patients who are older or frailer using alkylator agents and low doses. So a number of treatments to choose from, and therefore a number of combinations that we can use for our patients in the early stages of their disease.
So with these early therapies, let's spend a minute on resistance, which is always an ongoing challenge in multiple myeloma. As a relapsing remitting disease, resistance to several lines of therapy early on can often be expected and throughout the course of the disease. So how does treatment resistance occur at various stages of the disease, and what are the next classes or the next sets of agents that you have on your list?
So the approach to treatment of multiple myeloma in general, as we say, is to some degree kick the can down the road. And the reason why we say it is we want to really use and optimize our therapies to have them be as effective for as deep and as durable of response as we possibly can. And even today in 2023, that approach really leads to prolonged or continuous therapy where you are using treatments to continually suppress or keep a lid on, if you will, the disease itself. Now, the disease and why it happens is a whole other conversation, but we certainly believe that there are kind of maybe DNA or mutations or what we would call clones or different aspects of the multiple myeloma that can kind of quote unquote be put to sleep, if you will, or lie dormant with treatments. And what happens with resistance over time is as you use the same treatments for months and potentially, you know, years ongoing, the myeloma becomes, let's just call it smart. It figures out how to outsmart that drug and figures out how that it can kind of pop up in a different way. I think of it to some degree simplistically as like whack-a-mole, right? You really use these treatments in order to kind of keep a lid on certain aspects of the disease itself, knowing that at some point something else in the background is going to pop up that you have to deal with. And so it's a little bit of a relapsing and remitting process that happens because some drugs are going to be better at suppressing one clone, whereas another clone may not be. And over time, as all these clones start to emerge, you end up with a multi-drug resistant cancer that has multiple clones that have become resistant. And that's where it's very important for us to say, let's use all the drugs we have at our disposal, you know, early on in the process, but understand that at some point we are going to require new options to suppress these new and treatment resistant subclones that have evolved over time. And so when we're looking for next lines of therapy, we're looking for new drugs that have a different mechanism of action. So we mentioned proteasome inhibitors and CD38 monoclonal antibody as, you know, very potent drug classes for the treatment of multiple myeloma, but we're going to need something else and something different. And, you know, many of our what we call solid tumor colleagues or even some of our other blood cancers have really benefited from targeted therapies. And finally, multiple myeloma has had its kind of time in the light here now where we have found and, you know, identified novel targets on multiple myeloma cells that can be kind of exploited in order to develop new drugs. And some of these drugs include BCMA-targeted therapies, as an example. BCMA is a cell surface antigen on the multiple myeloma cell that has been targeted with a variety of different therapies. But there are other monoclonal antibodies, for example, one targeting SLAMF7. As mentioned previously, alkylating agents are another option for early or late stage disease. XPO1 inhibitors offer another class of drugs. And really with all of these different kind of next generation therapies targeting novel antigens on the myeloma cell, it offers new opportunities.
So one of the classes you just mentioned above is the BCMA targeting agents, in which there has been a lot of recent activity. So what's available currently and what's on the horizon in this area?
Now, fortunately, despite the chaos of COVID these last many years, we have been able and fortunate to have the FDA still continue to work hard with drug approvals for the treatment of multiply relapsed multiple myeloma and have seen four different drugs targeting BCMA approved in the last few years. Now, this has offered three different classes of BCMA-targeted therapies to patients who have had four or more prior lines of therapy. Now, those classes include CAR T cell, so a BCMA directed and genetically modified autologous T cell product. This is there are two BCMA CAR T cells, ide-cel and cilta-cel, that were approved in 2021 and 2022 respectively, where patients have their own T cells, quote unquote, harvested or removed and genetically modified to train them, if you will, to look for the BCMA target in their own multiple myeloma. And this has been a very exciting therapy that has been become available, although it has its kind of limitations in terms of access and manufacturing concerns. It continues in its development to be able to potentially be offered in earlier lines of therapy, something we are very excited about. So CAR T cell therapy available now at more often than not academic centers or kind of highly trained centers that can offer this therapy. Now, the first BCMA-targeted therapy was belantamab mafodotin, which was a BCMA-directed antibody drug conjugate, where with the same target, it was able to make contact with the myeloma cell with BCMA. However, with the drug conjugate part, was able to kind of induce cell toxicity that way by, quote unquote, injecting, you know, a chemo into the cell to kill it. Now, this ended up with quite a bit of what's called keratopathy or eye toxicity, and which really required a pretty extensive REMS program. In late 2022, the drug, however, itself was the license applications, I should say, the biologic license application for the drug has been withdrawn, and there are no new patients that are able to be enrolled. So at the moment, this drug is not available, with hopes that we're going to see kind of improvements or next generations of this drug that can offer therapy opportunities for patients. But the one that is the most recently approved is called teclistamab. This is a bispecific BCMA-directed CD3 T-cell engager, which is the first in its drug class to be approved, but not the last. I think it's very clear that there are multiple other BCMA-targeted T-cell engagers that are in development now, all of which have slightly different outcomes, slightly different administration schedules, whether it's intravenous or subcutaneous, whether it's weekly or every other week, or kind of has an administration schedule that gets extended. There are many in development with elranatamab, alnuctamab, linvoseltamab as just examples of these that are all kind of racing to the finish line to see who will get the next drug approval. And will be interesting to see as all of these BCMA T-cell engagers come to market, how we will use them in combination with many of our other BCMA targeted therapies. And it may come down to disease biology, access, to some degree, fitness of the patient. We have much to kind of understand still with these very exciting drugs, how to sequence them and how to choose the best one for any individual patient. So stay tuned, Chris.
Yeah, definitely an area that's rich with possibilities. So I wanted to end on this. This particular podcast was based on what we call a regional series, in which we put together educational programs in several different areas of the United States. With regard to multiple myeloma, can you identify any ways in which it may be managed differently in different parts of the country? I know that's a difficult question, but perhaps comparing your location in Southern California to the East Coast or other areas of the U.S.?
You're right. That is a hard question. I'd like to think that treatment is the same across the board, but I think it does come down still to access. You know, different payer mixes sometimes means different access to therapies. And, you know, California has, you know, a different payer mix than the East Coast, you know, and for that matter has, you know, like any different region of the country, different socioeconomic factors, different racial representation. I think all of those go into choosing any individual therapy for each patient. And I think, sadly, but realistically, those are all factors that can change what the approach to therapy may be. Although in the ideal state, we are all, you know, treating every patient exactly the same. But those realities, I think, do exist.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Costello. This has been really informative, and I'm glad we could spend some time talking about some of the issues in multiple myeloma and how the treatment landscape is evolving. But that's all the time we have for today. I would like to thank our expert, Dr. Caitlin Costello, for taking the time to speak with us today. And thank you to all of our listeners for joining us. hopefully you're able to tune into other podcasts or educational programming offered by MedLearning Group. This podcast was brought to you by MedLearning Group. MedLearning Group is accredited by the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education to provide continuing medical education for physicians. This CME activity was planned and produced in accordance with the ACCME Essentials. I would also like to give a special thank you to our grant supporter, Regeneron Pharmaceuticals Incorporated, who provided an educational grant for this activity. Thanks very much and have a great day.